From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, we meet the makers of the film Ghost World, one of the most critically acclaimed films of the summer. It's about two smart and cynical teenage girls who are alienated from their families and the people in their high school. They see themselves as misfits. The film is based on the adult comic Ghost World by Daniel Clowes. He co-wrote the screenplay with Terry Zwigoff, who also directed Crumb, the documentary about underground comic book artist R. Crumb. Daniel Clowes and Terry Zwigoff coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Frank Stacio. From NPR News in Washington, I'm Frank Stacio. The Justice Department says it is still seeking antitrust penalties against Microsoft, but not the breakup of the software giant. The government says it wants to end the case against Microsoft as soon as possible. Microsoft had fought against the breakup, but a company spokesman said today, "We remain committed to resolving the remaining issues in the case." Mexican President Vicente Fox addressed a joint meeting of Congress today and called on lawmakers to revamp immigration laws to benefit Mexicans migrating to the U.S. NPR's David Wellner reports from the Capitol.
Congress has long had a testy relationship with Mexico, but members from both chambers joined today to give Vicente Fox a warm welcome that included a 3-minute standing ovation. Fox pointed to his election last year, which broke more than 7 decades of authoritarian rule by one party, as grounds for the U.S. and Mexico to forge a new relationship.
Let us foster trust between our societies. Let us build trust along our common border. Let us take the road less traveled by and build confidence every step of the way.
Fox asked Congress to revamp rules to allow millions of undocumented Mexicans working in this country to gain legal status. But polls show a majority of Americans against amnesty, and lawmakers seem reluctant to push through such a measure. David Wellner, NPR News, the Capitol.
Israeli Foreign Minister Shimon Peres says he'll meet sometime next week with Palestinian leader Yasser Arafat. Peres made the announcement in Italy as he arrived for a meeting with that country's foreign minister. He did not say exactly when or where the meeting would take place. Delegates of the World Conference Against Racism have still not been able to reconcile differences over the issue of past slavery and colonialism. From Durban, NPR's Julie McCarthy reports.
The conference, billed as a milestone in the international battle against racism, has struggled with how to acknowledge the historic injustice caused by slavery and colonialism. African states and the African diaspora are holding firm in their position that states that enriched themselves through the transatlantic slave trade and colonial rule ought to formally apologize. European states are prepared to express remorse, but fear an outright apology will lead to legal demands for financial reparations. The African bloc says reparations could be channeled into development assistance and debt relief. An argument also persists over whether slavery should be designated a crime against humanity. African and Caribbean states say justice requires no less. Julie McCarthy, NPR News, Durban.
Bob Hope is out of the hospital. He'd been treated for the past week and a half for pneumonia. Doctors in Burbank, California, say he'll need several more weeks of recovery at home. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average fell 192 points. It closed at 98.40. The Nasdaq Composite Index was down 53, closing at 1705. The S&P 500 was down 25. This is NPR. In Northern Ireland, Protestant demonstrators continue their protest as children and parents made their way to a Catholic Belfast school. However, there was less violence today after yesterday's bomb attack on the children. Marianne McGuire has more from Belfast.
This morning, whistles and horns replaced the sound of bomb blasts. The Catholic parents and children walked to the school under heavy police and military escort. There were more parents and children than ever before. Yesterday, they were the target of a bomb as they made their way to the school gates. But today, the children, although nervous, seemed more confident. The local Protestant residents who have pledged to continue their protest turned their backs to them as they walked up to the school. Their action today marks a stark change of tactics in their campaign to stop the Catholic girls from going through their neighbourhood to get to their classrooms. For NPR News, I'm Marianne McGuire in Belfast.
The Macedonian Parliament voted overwhelmingly today to draft reforms aimed at granting greater civil rights to the nation's ethnic Albanian minority. The deal is a key piece to a Western-backed peace plan with the ethnic Albanian guerrillas. Legislators cleared the first big hurdle, authorizing a procedure to rewrite parts of the Constitution. A safety expert told a Senate hearing today that it's getting harder to keep the aging space shuttle fleet safe. Columbia is the oldest shuttle. It's been flying for 20 years. NASA would like to keep the fleet flying for at least another decade, but the chairman of the nation's aerospace safety panel says some key systems won't last that long and need to be replaced. Florida Democrat Bill Nelson says government bean counters have been getting in the way. I'm Frank Stacio, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Archer Daniels Midland Company, maker of all-natural vitamin E, ADM, the nature of what's to come, on the web at admworld.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. One of this summer's most favorably reviewed movies is Ghost World. It's based on a comic book by my guest Daniel Clowes, one of today's most highly regarded creators of comics for adults. He co-wrote the screenplay with the film's director, Terry Zwigoff, who we'll meet later in the show. Ghost World is about two teenage girls, Enid and Rebecca, who have just graduated high school and are in that limbo between school and whatever happens next, maybe college, maybe a job, who knows. The girls are smart and cynical. They're alienated from their families and the kids from their high school. They identify with the losers and misfits of the world. Although these two girls are best friends, they're starting to drift apart for reasons they don't quite understand. Enid is played by Thora Birch, who played the daughter in American Beauty, and Scarlett Johansson plays Rebecca, who played the daughter in The Horse Whisperer. Daniel Clowes, welcome to Fresh Air.
Hello there.
What's your description of the two girls in Ghost World?
Well, I always think of Enid as sort of representing my id somewhat. She's sort of this uncontrolled character who sort of reacts impulsively, and she's sort of unable to fit in the world. She has this sense that there's something in the world that's better than what she sees, but she doesn't exactly know what that thing is, and she's constantly searching for that thing. Whereas Rebecca is sort of the kind of character who sort of sees things as they are and tries to accept them as they are and tries to make the best of it and make the best of what is around her. And so there's this sort of conflict between these two characters. It's like an id and a superego battling it out.
In some ways, Enid feels like a loser and identifies with losers, but at the same time, she looks down on losers, like she looks down on a lot in the world. It's kind of contradictory in that sense.
Well, she's a real person. I mean, I think of her as a real person. She's not an archetype. I mean, mostly you see characters like that who are, you know, just sort of one way. They are the kind of girl who just mocks everything and looks down on everything, and they tend to be very one note. And I think of Enid as a very rounded character. She sort of both, you know, sort of hates herself and hates the world and loves the world and loves herself. And it's all, you know, combines in this weird mixture that makes for sort of a much more interesting character, I think.
What connection do you feel to teenage girls, a connection strong enough to enable you to create them for Ghost World?
I think I have a very sort of adolescent sense about me. I think if you were to wake me up in the middle of the night and ask me how old I was, I would probably say I was 18. I think I got sort of stuck in that part of my life emotionally to some degree, and I really identify with that time in your life when you're ending childhood and you're beginning adulthood, and you don't really know what you are or where you fit in or what you're doing. I think there's this certain confusion and sort of heightened excitement at that time in your life that makes for some really interesting drama. And I think it's something I keep sort of looking back to in my own work and my own sort of daily thought patterns.
When you were in high school and shortly after high school, did you, like Enid in Ghost World, carry a sketch pad and sketch people who struck you as particularly interesting or particularly ridiculous?
Oh, sure. Yeah, no, I drew all the kids in my high school class, you know, and a variety of, you know, sexual positions with, you know, animals and things like that. And, you know, drew all the teachers. And my, of course, once a year that one of the teachers would pick up my notebook, you know, while I was obviously not paying attention in class and read it out loud to the whole class, you know, humiliating me. But, you know, and I, of course, I still do that. I still every day draw little notes and pictures about people I'm observing.
The colors in the movie adaptation of Ghost World are really vivid and wonderful and contribute a lot of energy to the movie. The comic book of Ghost World is in black and white with like a blue tinge cast over it. What did you think about what the palette should be like for the movie? Did you participate in that at all?
Terry and I spoke, you know, talked about that quite a bit in the beginning when we were trying to visualize the look of the film. I mean, you know, there was some sense that it would have been cool to sort of replicate the look from the comic in the film, where there's this sort of eerie blue light that looks sort of like the light from a TV set through a window at dusk or something, which was sort of the look I was going for in the comic. But you know, we thought that would just seem really pretentious in a film. It would just seem very arty. And we wanted the film to have this kind of beautiful look, but not like the typical Hollywood movie, and not like the typical replication of that comic book palette that you see in a lot of Hollywood movies when they try to sort of camp it up and do like in Dick Tracy, where everybody's sort of primary colors and it's all sort of overdone. We wanted it to have this kind of exaggerated look, but the exaggerated palette of like a modern strip mall, kind of where everything's kind of screaming for your attention and everything's in these like bright sort of candy colors that are trying to attract you. And we wanted the world to sort of look like that. So it was sort of on the outside kind of, it's trying to appeal to you in this sort of almost childish way. But underneath it all, it had some sort of vague sinister quality, which that's a lot to ask of a cinematographer. But I think Afonso Beato did a pretty amazing job.
You collaborated with Terry Zwigoff on the screenplay adaptation of Ghost World. Did he have any insights about your stories or the characters that showed you things you didn't realize about your own creation?
Well, I have to say that Terry really never did tell me what the story was about. Terry was the most amazingly collaborative person I can imagine, especially for what I've heard about movie directors. I mean, he encouraged me to move down to Hollywood with him. I wound up living in a shabby old film noirish hotel for 6 months in Culver City, going to the set every day at 5 a.m, working with Terry pretty much nonstop throughout the whole process till, you know, about halfway through editing, I couldn't stand it anymore and I went back home. But he was amazingly receptive to anything I had to offer and really let me sort of dictate those two girls. He really knew that I knew those two characters, and he let me sort of, you know, pick their costumes and sort of tell me what the intent was with their lines and things like that. So it was, it was a great experience. I mean, few screenwriters get that kind of an opportunity, I guess.
You've said that you learned that a good actor can make pages of dialogue seem extraneous with just one look. Is there an example you could give from the movie Ghost World?
Well, Thora does that constantly. There's pages and pages of Enid's dialogue that have been cut out. You know, you can see, you know, we have just shots of her sitting in her room, sitting on the floor, looking off into space, and those are often scenes that had lines and lines of dialogue of her explaining her dilemma at that moment. And, you know, you just see her expression, and in 1 second it registered as you know, what we were trying to say, and all the lines seem just totally extraneous. You can see just the way when those two girls finally sort of are starting to break apart, there's a scene where they're sitting in that quality cafe diner sort of staring at each other, and there's just a moment where you see Thora realizes that Scarlett isn't quite getting what she's talking about, and that they're not quite as close as she thought, and she just registers that with this subtle look, but it's, you know, we wound up cutting out 2 pages just because of that look.
Now, this realization that you had in making the movie that just the right look can make pages of dialogue unnecessary, did that affect your drawing style in subsequent comics? Did you try to get that precise look on the face of a character to make some of the writing unnecessary?
Well, I've always tried to do that in my comics, and comics are just such a much less visceral medium than film. And in film, you know, you respond to it very emotionally and very immediately, and you kind of have to be in the moment in a film, and the audience is so much more attuned to everything in a film. And in a comic, it's sort of more cerebral. I mean, you're sort of reading these symbols. You're not really looking at real life in the way that you are in a film. You're looking at these kind of icons that represent things. You know, you're looking at symbols of trees and symbols of people and symbols of buildings, and you have to sort of bring to it your own experience, and you have to sort of collaborate with the cartoonist when you're reading a comic. And when you're watching a movie, you're really being sort of dictated to, you're being sort of led through it in a much more emotionally direct way, I think. So it's just not the same thing.
Now, the character of Enid has a scene in a comic book store. She doesn't like the people who work in the store. They mock her, and the people who work in the store are all young guys. What's your experiences with comic book stores and with the culture inside them?
I try to have as little to do with that whole culture as possible. I mean, I find it very alienating. I feel like it has very little to do with what I do. I mean, the typical comic store sells mostly only superhero comics that are geared for an audience of sort of perpetual adolescents, most of which are not adolescents at all, but 30 to 40-year-old men who, for some reason, are stuck in this part of their lives where they really need these kind of power fantasies. And it's just sort of endlessly annoying and alienating to me. I've really no relation to it. I feel very separate from it. I find it sort of aesthetically vulgar or something. I mean, that sounds a little snooty, but it's not something I want to be attuned to at all.
My guest is comic book artist Daniel Clowes. He co-wrote the screenplay for Ghost World, which is based on his comic of the same name. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is comic book artist Dan Clowes, and his comic Ghost World is the basis of the movie Ghost World. He co-wrote the screenplay with the director Terry Zwigoff. When did you start drawing comics?
Before I could read, actually. My brother left me a giant pile of comics in his room, and I used to look at those and sort of try to piece together the weird archetypes you'd see in these old comics, which are all, you know, superheroes and monsters and idiots and hags and caves and all these strange sort of mythological archetypes. And I tried to sort of draw my own versions of these very crudely when I was 4 or 5 years old.
What kind of stories would you make up?
Oh, I mean, mostly they were just very imitative. You know, the early ones were kind of, I'd do stories that were sort of like Jimmy Olsen comics. He was sort of Superman's friend, and so I would do these stories about a kid who was like the friend of the superhero, which is, you know, it's fairly obvious. But and then as I got older, I started becoming more and more interested in things like Mad Magazine, and I would do like my own bad movie parodies and things like that. And I was looking through some old drawings the other day, and I found I had drawings of people like Spiro Agnew and Dean Rusk and like people who I don't even know who they are. They were like, you know, political figures of their day. And for some reason, I thought that was what I should be doing, is like drawing caricatures of like 50-year-old balding men.
You went to art school. You went to the Pratt Institute in New York. And one of your early comics, the first edition of 8-Ball, had a story called Art School Confidential. And
yes,
in it you write, "Art School Confidential blows the lid off a million-dollar racket. See rich guys who draw worse than your 7-year-old sister. See has-been famous artist professors who couldn't teach a dog to bark. Self-obsessed neurotic art girls who make their own clothes." And you write, the teachers aren't there to help you. Most of them are still freelancers, and the last thing they want is more competition. They're there because they need a steady paycheck, and they hope to score with the students. Does that kind of sum up your reaction to art school?
Yeah, I mean, I'm not exaggerating with that. I mean, that was how I felt. I mean, when I went to art school, it cost me, I think, $8,000 to go for all 4 years, and now it's like that much for one unit. You know, it costs like $60,000 or $100,000 to go to art school, and I think, you know, one out of 500 people actually make a living as an artist. So it's definitely a racket.
Let me play an art school scene from Ghost World. This is an art class, I should say. Enid is taking an art class, and her teacher, played by Ileana Douglas, at this point is reviewing the students' art projects. And she's holding up Enid's class submission, which is Enid's comic sketchbook.
What can you tell us about this piece?
Enid. Well, it's kind of a diary, I guess.
Colorful. I think that Philip and Enid can help us to see that there are many different ways we can express ourselves. We can do things like these cartoons that are amusing as a sort of a light entertainment, or we can do work that is more serious in scope and feeling and that deals with issues, emotional, spiritual, political, of great importance.
In the comic book Ghost World and in the movie Ghost World, there's one student artwork that consists of a tampon in a teacup. And in the movie, it's submitted by a woman student, and it's supposed to be making a feminist statement. In the comic book version, it's submitted by a male student, and it's called Tangerine Amoeba Apartheid Heartbeat Number 4. was this based on a real art submission in high school or college?
I'm actually afraid I could be sued for that by the poor guy who turned that in.
And what was your reaction to the piece when you saw it in real life?
Oh, I just thought it was one of those brilliant things where he obviously hadn't done his homework and he was sitting there at the breakfast table that morning and he got the brilliant idea to put a tampon in his teacup and bring it in. And that's the beauty of art school is he sort of got away with it. I think he probably got, you know, like a C+ or something for that.
Well, in your comic Art Book Confidential, you write, seldom will you be afforded the chance to scrutinize such an array of losers in an environment that actually encourages their most pretentious inclinations.
Yeah, that's the beauty of it all. I mean, it's this world where, you know, you're not going there to learn to do painting techniques and things like that. You're going to learn how to express yourself and to, you know, you're being taught by people who are sort of abstract expressionists or conceptual artists who have no sense of how to, you know, paint a horse or to draw in perspective or anything like that. So God forbid you should learn anything useful like that. You're taught to sort of fit into the art world in some way, and to everybody goes with this sort of intention of showing what a genius they are, and it can be quite amusing.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Daniel Klaus. He's a comic book artist. His comic Ghost World has been adapted into the film Ghost World. He co-wrote the screenplay for the adaptation with the director, Terry Zwigoff. Tell me if I have the story right. When you were very young, your stepfather, who was a race car driver, was killed in an accident during a race.
Yeah.
And then you were sent to live with your grandparents for a while.
Well, no, I lived with my mother on a couple days a week, and then I'd go live with my father for a couple days a week, and then I'd live with my grandmother for a couple days a week.
Oh, so I see.
Fairly confusing.
Oh, it must have been confusing.
Yeah, although it was kind of fun. You'd never get bored with any one place.
Right.
I always had a different, you know, I'd always get three birthday parties and all that stuff.
You know what I was wondering? If it affected your sense of risk-taking to have your stepfather, who was a race car driver, which is a kind of risky profession, actually die in an accident.
Well, it definitely made me aware of mortality at a very young age. And, I don't think most kids think about, you know, violent death that much when they're 5 years old, but that was something that's sort of preoccupied me my whole life.
Moving from house to house between your mother, your father, and your grandmother, did you have a different visual world in each of those households, different tchotchkes on display or different pop culture things, different records, different TV shows that were on?
Yeah, I mean, I think I had an entirely different persona, really, in each household, and they were all sort of valid parts of myself, but I think I acted differently in each scenario, and I think that's a bit where the Enid thing comes from, of her sort of constantly trying out all these different roles and in her case, it's things like outfits and just interests and things like that, and I think that's a bit where that character comes from.
What have you done to interact with teenage girls so you could really understand how teenage girls talk today and what they talk about and what slang they use?
Well, I tried to write it in this more sort of universal language. I tried to use the kind of slang that kind of stays around for a while. I didn't want to have stuff that was up to the moment. I didn't want to use kind of hip-hop slang and whatever's current right now. I wanted this movie and the comic to be something that people could read in 20 or 30 years and still have some idea of what they were talking about and have it not seem, dated and something of its era necessarily. And as far as hanging around teenage girls, I don't really know any teenage girls. I remember them. You know, I remember how they were when I was in high school. And my wife is sort of a proto-Enid type, and I always, would sort of check things with her, and see if she thought I was being accurate about the way these girls were acting. But, it's all sort of through osmosis, just sort of picking it up here and there.
Did you meet your proto-Enid wife before or after you created Enid?
After.
Did she think of herself as being like the character?
No, I think she's greatly insulted by that.
Well, Dan Clowes, I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
Well, thank you.
Daniel Clowes co-wrote the screenplay for Ghost World, which is based on his comic book of the same name. His latest graphic novel is called David Boring. We'll hear from the director of Ghost World in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, and by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. From the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, promoting excellence in journalism worldwide and investing in the vitality of 26 U.S. communities. And from Wilmington Trust, a wealth management company providing investment and trust services to individuals, families, and corporations nationwide for nearly 100 years. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we meet the director of Ghost World, Terry Zwigoff, who also directed the documentary Crumb. Although Ghost World is based on a comic by Daniel Clowes, Zwigoff created the film's character, Seymour, played by Steve Buscemi. Seymour is a middle-aged guy who collects blue 78s and is uncomfortable around people, kind of like Zwigoff.
Thank you.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Terry Zwigoff, directed the film Ghost World and co-wrote the screenplay with Daniel Clowes, who we just heard from. Ghost World is based on Clowes' comic book of the same name. Terry Zwigoff also directed the acclaimed documentary Crumb about the underground comic book artist R. Crumb. Zwigoff has seen a lot of comic books over the years, in part because his wife has worked for a comic book distribution company which puts out work by Crumb, Clowes, and many other artists. After the success of Zwigoff's film Crumb, he was sent a lot of screenplays and received offers to direct Hollywood films. But he said the stories seemed generic, false, and contrived. I asked Zwigoff how he chose Ghost World as his next film.
As I was struggling to find something to make a movie out of, my wife kept pushing me to make Ghost World into a film. And I went back and reread it and thought, you know, this doesn't really have a story. It's just this little episodic slice of life vignettes of these two teenage girls, but I really loved the two characters. I thought they were really well written. I thought the dialogue was terrific. And in fact, I wound up asking Robert Crumb about Dan Clowes because I knew he lived, I think, in Berkeley. And since I lived in San Francisco, I wanted to meet the guy and talk to him about the possibility of just working together on a screenplay instead of adapting this Ghost World per se. I actually liked all of Dan's work I had read everything he had done, and he's a pretty prolific guy, and I was impressed with his writing skills, the fact that he could write such good dialogue and the fact that he was so good with characters. It was very uncomic book like. It was much more like a novel, you know, where the characters are much more three-dimensional. And then when you go to pitch it in Hollywood, the irony is that they want very one-dimensional characters. And they that's sort of why they like comic books, I guess, down there. But this was very uncomic book like in that regard.
What did you think were the most important changes you needed to make in order to adapt the comic book into a movie?
I thought we had to add more of a story, more of a plot. And I also just didn't want to do the same thing he'd already done in comic book form. It just wasn't interesting to me to repeat something. So we started going through and talking about different stories and different plot lines. And I was, at the time, very much influenced, I think, in retrospect, I was very much influenced by this movie Scarlet Street by Fritz Lang, this 1945 Edward G. Robinson film. And I started throwing out plot ideas based on that film where this older guy gets involved with this young sort of femme fatale. I was also influenced a lot by that Vladimir Nabokov book Lolita, and I love the Kubrick film, of course, and that sort of worked its way in as well. I don't know, all these different things sort of worked their way into the story, and we talked and talked and worked this thing out, and just wound up coming up with something new where this Enid character gets involved with this older guy who's a record collector. And I think originally I added that Seymour character who's played by Steve Buscemi so well in the film because that was just something, some world I knew very well, that record collecting world, and he's rather based on myself. It was very easy for me to write him because I just sort of exaggerated things about myself.
The Steve Buscemi character in Ghost World collects blues 78s.
Blues and jazz, yes.
And he's a character who has no real social skills, and he's particularly self-conscious and insecure around women. So what are some of the characters of yourself that you heightened in him?
Well, I didn't think I heightened all that much sometimes, but when I read it in the press, it's sort of alarming because I remember the first couple days I hired this woman who was the costume designer who was really great, Mary Zofries. She did the costume design on Fargo and also Kingpin, two of my favorite films, and two very divergent films in terms of costumes. She said, "How do you want Seymour to dress?" I said, "I don't, just look at the way I dress, you know, sort of normal. Just look at the way I dress for the next 3 days and base it on me." And she did. She just had him wearing like sort of dark, conservative clothes, you know, long sleeve shirts and stuff. And then I read in the press, everybody says, "God, he has the most pathetic wardrobe of any human on the planet." I said, "What? What? That's sort of normal looking. I don't understand it. I don't get it."
Well, it's also that some of his clothes seem slightly too big, and they seem to be droopy.
I guess
on
that's,
him. I think that's
maybe
part
she
of the
based
look.
That on me. Yeah, I don't know. I thought he looked pretty normal to me. At the same time, every time we'd get done with the day and we'd wrap for the day, Steve would immediately change clothes and change the way he combed his hair. I could tell he was very uncomfortable inside that character.
Let me play one of the early meetings between Enid, the teenage girl, and Seymour, the middle-aged record collector played by Steve Buscemi. And earlier in the movie, she's bought at a garage sale that he has. She's bought a blues anthology, and she's coming back to say that she actually really likes it. So here's the scene.
Yeah, it's took me a while before I got a chance to actually play it, but once I heard that song, it was like...
You liked it, huh? Yeah. There's some really rare performances. What about, did you like the Memphis Mini?
Yeah, that was good, too. The whole record was good, but that one song, Devil Got My Woman, I mostly just keep playing that over and over. Do you have any other records like that?
There aren't no other records like that. Actually, I have the original 78 in my collection. It's one of maybe five known copies.
Wow.
You want to see it? I can run upstairs and get it.
Sure, yeah.
Watch my stuff.
There you go.
It's only about B minus. It's got an incipient lamp crack, but it plays decent as I recall.
Oops, I dropped it!
Jeez.
I was only kidding.
Yeah.
Seymour, are you all right?
Yeah, it's just, it's very valuable.
The Rare 78 from Seymour's collection that Enid really likes and that gets her kind of interested in early blues is Skip James singing Devil Got My Woman. Why did you build the scene around that particular recording? What does it mean to you?
To me, it was the first record I ever heard that really affected me deeply. It was very shocking to me when I heard that record. I was in New York. I was at this guy Nick Pearls' house, who's now dead, but he used to run Yazoo Records, and he was a rich guy. He had the world's best collection of blues records, pre-war blues records. And he was just playing records, and I was in this room looking through his trade pile in a corner, and I just stopped dead when, you know, like two bars into that record. I don't know. It was an electrifying record to me, shockingly weird and strong.
Why don't we listen to it? This is Skip James singing Devil Got My Woman.
Oh, Lord, I'll be the devil. I'll be that woman, man. Oh, Lord, I'll be the devil. I'll be that woman, man.
That's Skip James singing Devil Got My Woman. It's included on the soundtrack of the movie Ghost World. My guest, Terry Zwigoff, directed the film. There's a record collecting scene at a party that Seymour gives. And, you know, everybody there except Enid is a collector of rare records. And all the conversation they're having is about the condition of the records in their collection. And she kind of thinks it's pretty cool. And Seymour says, you think it's healthy to obsessively collect things? You can't connect with other people, so you fill your life with stuff. I'm just like the rest of all these pathetic collector losers. Do you really think of collecting as being pathetic?
Yeah, in some ways. I had a hard time writing that line as well. I almost took it out because I wrote it. Actually, I wrote it with Charles Crumb in mind. I wanted to make Seymour have this sort of tragic self-awareness that Charles Crumb had.
Charles Crumb is R. Crumb's late brother.
Yeah, and I thought that would be very strong in the character. It's not really, I can't really be that objective and tell you whether or not I really have that quality or not. I guess to some degree I do, but I kept wavering on whether or not to do that, to keep that line, and it seemed too obvious, and other ways it seemed very, very truthful, so I don't know. I wound up going with the line. But yeah, there's a little bit of truth in it, sure.
My guest is Terry Zwigoff. He directed and co-wrote the film Ghost World. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Terry Zwigoff. He directed the film Ghost World, which he co-wrote with Daniel Clowes. The film is based on Clowes' comic book of the same name. It's about two smart and cynical teenage girls who see themselves as misfits. Steve Buscemi plays a middle-aged guy who collects blues 78s.
I really love the record collecting scenes in this. There's a scene that I particularly like later on in a bar. You know, Enid and Seymour are going to a bar to hear an old performer who Seymour quite likes and is really disappointed that this guy isn't the headliner. And the headliner
right.
is this
Blues Hammer is the headliner.
Yeah, they're this really awful bar band. And so Buscemi's sitting next to a woman at the table, and she says, "Oh, I really love the blues," after this performer that Buscemi likes has performed, and he corrects her. And he says...
Can't help himself.
Yeah, he says, actually...
He has to correct her.
He says, actually, technically, what he was mostly playing would more accurately be classified in the ragtime idiom, although, of course, not in the strictest sense of the more classical ragtime piano music like that of Scott Joplin or Joseph Lamb. I thought it was really funny the way he corrected her. And then she goes on to say that she really loves the blues, and that, you know, if he loves the blues, he's got to see this band, Blues Hammer, because they're so great. And, of course, they're really horrible, and they're everything, probably, that he hates about Ersatz contemporary blues bands.
White guys sing about plowing behind mules.
Yeah, and singing in black dialect, and singing about being old.
I've been through that experience many times.
Have you? Uh-huh.
I cannot tell you how many times I've been dragged to a bar by some, usually not a girl I've met at the bar, some girl I've just started dating, and... Okay, we'll go hear some blues, try to find some middle ground in the relationship. And something like that would happen. And the problem in that scene was how far to push it before the audience actually got it. I could have made that a lot more subtle, but it's hard to tell, hard to be objective.
Is that as alienating for you as it is for the Buscemi character when someone says, "I really love blues," and you think, oh, a bond, a connection, and you realize what they love isn't anything like what you would call blues?
Yeah, I don't even bother to try to turn people on to old music anymore. If they come to my house, they always, out of politeness, say, "Oh, all these old records, let's hear some." I say, "Eh, it's all right. My record player isn't working." I'm happy to keep it for myself. I don't care if anybody else ever hears that stuff. It just drives the price up. What do I care? I can't afford to buy the records I want on eBay anymore.
Now, you wrote or co-wrote the bar band song, the Blues Hammer song, didn't you?
Yeah, I did.
Tell me about writing it. Did you write the music and the lyrics, or just the lyrics?
It was just sort of a generic, you know, three-chord 12-bar blues thing that a friend of mine, Craig Ventresco, who did a lot of the soundtrack on Crumb, actually did most of the music behind it. He actually played the slide guitar part, even though he only plays, like, old-fashioned music. He's able to, like, play all the parts of that modern band. And I just came up with that. Those stupid lyrics, they're just so offensive to me that some white guys would, but that's not that far from reality. White guys singing like that in black dialect, talking about, you know, plowing behind a mule, lordy, lordy.
Well, let's hear the recording. It's actually on the soundtrack of Ghost World. Now, the Steve Buscemi character was largely your creation, the record collector character.
Yeah, I originally added him to the story because I actually wanted an excuse. We kept going down to Hollywood pitch meetings to pitch this film. And the first thing they'd say is, oh, great, it's based on a comic. That's good. We have X-Men, and that's going to make a lot of money. And Lara Croft, and Spider-Man, and all this stuff. Batman's all made money. And then they start talking about the soundtrack. They really want a pop soundtrack. That's great. We have teenage girls' comic books, and we'll have, like, this hit soundtrack with NSYNC and the Backstreet Boys and who's ever big this week, you know. And I just said, you know, I got to figure out some way around this. So I wrote this main character into the film who collects old music just so I could use old music.
Now, the director of photography in the movie is the same director of photography who worked on Pedro Almodovar's All About My Mother, which is a beautiful-looking film with color almost being like one of the characters in the movie.
Yeah,
colors used so well. So who's most responsible for the color? The director of photography, yourself as the director, the fashion coordinator was actually choosing the clothes that everybody wears in the movie?
It's all important to some degree, all those choices, and we all talked about it. The first thing I did with the entire crew, including Mary Zofries, the costume designer, and the production designer, Ed McAvoy, and Afonso Beato, the cinematographers, I dragged them all out to a shopping mall in L.A., and we had a camera with a long lens on it, and we just looked at people walking by that I would point out going down this escalator that we had a good view of from about 100 feet away. And I just say, take a picture of that guy, look at this guy, look at that clothes there. And then we studied these photographs, and a lot of the colors, a lot of the wardrobe itself, a lot of the hairdos on the extras, all that stuff, I said, I'm very, very interested and concerned with creating an entire world down to the extras. All the background details are very important to me. So we studied those photos. It was very helpful.
What did you want from those background details, from the people, for instance? What kind of look did you want the extras to have?
It was really an homage to Robert Crumb. It was really something that I picked up from knowing him and from his comics. The way he sees modern Americans is just these sort of fat, unhealthy, out of shape, schlubby people shuffling along, most of them rather depressed, and they're just wearing these clothes that are ridiculous on them. They either have big ads for, you know, Nike or The Gap on them, or they some sports team, or, you know, some old guy wearing like a jogging outfit, and, you know, he can barely walk. He's got a walker, you know, he's shuffling along. And, you know, this stuff that's too stylish for their age or too stylish for their, you know, for their body type, their hairdo. All that stuff was important to me. And that was completely an homage to Robert Crumb.
What were some of the hurdles, if any, that you had to get over with the studio who maybe would have wanted the movie slightly more mainstream?
Well, the studio that we wound up with, United Artists, MGM, had a negative pickup deal, so they weren't too involved in the film creatively. They got it when it was done. The people that were involved were Granada Films in England, and domestically a company called Mr. Mud, which is my old friend Leanne Helfen, and her partner John Malkovich. And they held final cut of the film. We had our disagreements in the editing room, but eventually got to the point where they all backed off and sort of said, you know, this film's got to have one vision and let me do what I want to do, which is sort of remarkable in hindsight that I got to make this film and have final cut of it.
Let's talk a little bit about the look you wanted the two teenage girls, the two leads in the movie, to have. You may disagree, but I thought that they are more attractive in the movie than they're depicted as being in the comic book. And I thought, you know, that the slightly less attractive look in the comic book helped explain their feelings of alienation from the other kids in high school and, you know, from the world in general. Did you want to make them more attractive?
One of the best actors I could get was my main concern. I was less interested in what they looked like.
Mm-hmm.
It turned out that you know, the other main concern is getting the studio to finally greenlight a film that, you know, you're going to have actresses in that they have no interest in. They want the biggest actresses that are out there. And at the time we started pitching this thing 6 years ago, the biggest actress they were interested in was Jennifer Love Hewitt, because she had just done this film, I Know What You Did Last Summer. So they all wanted her, and I just said, you know, it didn't strike me that she was too pretty, although I think she's very pretty. It struck me that she's sort of too perky and well-adjusted and happy. And I said that alone would not make her work in that part. And to me, it was more important that these actresses sort of got the mindset of those characters, which I thought they did very well. There is something genuinely off and eccentric about Scarlett Johansson. There is something generally of an outsider about Thora Birch. That was more important to me than the looks. Mm-hmm. And maybe they are a little bit too beautiful for those parts. I thought they were very, very good-looking, you know, actors. But to me, the performance supersedes that.
My guest is Terry Zwigoff. He directed and co-wrote the film Ghost World. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Terry Zwigoff. He directed the film Ghost World, which he co-wrote with Daniel Clowes. Zwigoff also directed the documentary Crumb about the comic book artist R. Crumb. What was most interesting and most upsetting to you working on your first fiction film? Your other films have been documentaries.
Right. Well, the biggest challenge and the most fun was actually working with actors. And when this thing was first starting up, 5 years ago, it seemed like it was a go project right away. We had this one studio that was going to make the film. My producer, Leanne Helfand, called me and said, pack your bags. You're going to move from San Francisco to L.A. in a month and start pre-production. So I sort of panicked, and I went through the Yellow Pages and found an acting instructor and went to them, and I said, can you give me a crash course in directing actors in a month? I have to direct the actors in this feature film. I don't have the slightest experience doing it. And to me, that's what makes or breaks a film, you know, good characters, good performances. So this guy looked at me and thought I was kidding. He said, I can't teach how to do that in a month. My advice would be to start going to acting classes and go to as many as you can before this thing starts up. So I did. I started going to acting classes here in San Francisco. Gene Shelton has an actor's workshop on Sutter Street that's really good. She was very nice to me. Let me sit in the back and audit the class for free. Went to a bunch of other acting classes. And this financing fell through, and thing dragged on for 5 years. I went to acting classes for years and years. It was very helpful.
How was it helpful?
Well, you learn how to talk to actors. You learn how to get a good performance. You have to learn how to relax them and get them focused and actually listening and affecting each other in a scene. And there's a lot of different techniques and tricks and methods for doing that.
Name one that you used in the making of Ghost World.
One method that I use?
Yeah, to relax an actor.
Sometimes to relax.
Or get them in focus.
I tried to keep the set a very fun set. Everybody that was there was always cracking jokes and laughing and having a ball. That was the first thing, just to keep everybody relaxed. And then, you know, oftentimes with Thor, I'd go through the script line by line. Just tell her the intention of the way it was written. If she didn't quite agree with it or didn't quite get it, you at least tell her the intention of it, of the you know, what you meant in this line. Would be a start. And then you try to give them positive playable choices. You know, you try to give them like a verb instead of like an end result, something to play, something active to play in the scene, so that they don't get too self-conscious and stagey with the performance.
Thora Birch has a particularly clear way of letting you know what she's feeling when she's giving a line by the slant of her eyes or the tilt of her head or the expression on her face. And it never looks like she's mugging for the camera, but you know what she's feeling by watching her.
A lot of it in a film, they just have to think it. They don't have to indicate it anymore. They just have to think it, and you can see it in their eyes. That's why I never liked plays as a kid. My parents used to take me to plays. I was never that into them. I never quite got the idea of it. Like, how can you get the same feeling from this performance sitting in the front row as you do in the back row? It's just, you know, it's different in films. Why I like films. You can be very nuanced and very subtle in film.
So are you already thinking what your next movie will be?
Oh, boy. I guess I better pretty soon. The standard of living has been raised. My wife made us get some cell phones, new computer. The overhead's going up. I have to pay the bills. I just turned down a $10,000 offer from The Gap to have my photo taken for The Gap. I said, what do you mean have my photo taken for The Gap? They said, yeah, we're doing an ad campaign and billboards and magazines of young, hip film directors. I said, I'm 53 years old. I'm not young. I'm not hip. I don't even wear blue jeans, you know. I'm sort of short, disheveled, graying guy with white, hairy arms. You're going to put me in like a Gap t-shirt? I think that's going to sell like Gap clothes? As tempting as that $10,000 was, you know, they employ sweatshop laborers in Saipan. You're not going to endorse that company. Screw them.
Were you flattered that they thought you could be a hip model for their clothes?
Clearly, you know, obviously they never even seen what I look like, and they know nothing about me or my politics. I'm sure they never even saw the film. If they saw that film, it'd be clear to any thinking person this is the last guy who's going to endorse The Gap. It's like 6 years of my life went into making some big statement against like this corporate consumerism sweeping the planet and ruining the earth.
Terry Zwigoff, I thought we could end your interview with one of the 78s that's included on the CD, the soundtrack CD from Ghost World. Why don't you choose one that you would like to introduce our listeners to?
One of my favorite records is The Palms of Maracaibo by Lionel Belasco and his orchestra. It's recorded in the late 20s. It's West Indian calypso music, really beautiful.
Well, let's hear it. Terry Zwigoff, thank you so much.
Thanks, Terry.
Terry Zwigoff directed and co-wrote the film Ghost World. He also directed the documentary Crumb about comic book artist R. Crumb. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced by Naomi Person, Phyllis Myers, Amy Sallet, Monique Nazareth, and Anne-Marie Baldonado, with Megan Howe, Patty Lessring, Jessica Chu, and Lauren Krenzel. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From Saab, maker of the 9.5 sedan and the 9.5 wagon. Independent quality and safety evaluations of Saab 9.5's performance available at saabusa.com. And from Bantam Books, a division of Random House, publisher of Lost Soldiers, a novel set in present-day Vietnam by James Webb, author of Fields of Fire. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, Mary Carr, author of the memoirs The Liars Club, about her childhood, and Cherry, about her teenage years and her sexual coming of age. Cherry has just been published in paperback. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.